All right, so it is 1 o'clock, so we're gonna kick off this training. Just to cover some housekeeping rules for today, this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Kluin for those who are not able to join us live. The Kluin training page offers the slides for you to download, and I've also posted a link to the slides in the chat. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of the modules today. For those of you who are interested in receiving certificates of completion, that will be available upon completion of the feedback form. Once you have completed the form and clicked the box to certify you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, also known as ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States, also known as ECOS. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating on today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On our website, you can register for teams, learn more about how you can be an active member, and the full ITRC disclaimer is also available on the website. So if you plan on using any ITRC materials, we ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training. ITRC Sediment Cap Chemical Isolation Guidance Document, which is an introduction to the ITRC online resources produced by ITRC in 2023. On slide five here, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers today. All of them have served as members on the team and volunteered to support the training offered today. If you run into any problems accessing a link during the training, you can navigate directly to the main guidance document and use the table of contents to find the specific trainings we are referencing. But at this time, I am going to be handing it off to Ashley Lesser.
Thank you. I'm excited to welcome you all to our webinar today about the ITRC Sediment Cap Chemical Isolation Guidance that was published in 2023. There are a number of technical references that are available that discuss different sediment remediation approaches and sediment capping specifically. One of those is the 2014 Contaminated Sediments Remediation Guidance that ITRC previously developed. Many of these technical reference materials remain valid and helpful for understanding sediment capping, but they tend to have a higher level focus. For example, the 2014 ITRC guidance provides a high-level overview of sediment remediation technologies, and it summarizes the key factors that should be considered when evaluating different cleanup options. One of the chapters of the 2014 ITRC guidance is dedicated to capping, and it provides useful information for deciding whether or not capping could be an effective remedial approach for any given site. Our team supports the information in the 2014 guidance, and we believe it is a valuable resource for projects that are in the alternatives analysis and remedy selection process. The new Sediment Cap Chemical Isolation Guidance was developed to supplement ITRC's 2014 guidance with the goal of improving consistency in the project phases that follow remedy selection. Our goal for the guidance was to go into detail about the design, construction, and performance monitoring for the chemical isolation function of CAPs, and to create a framework that could lead to more consistent designs and performance outcomes for CAPs. I'll let Werda continue with an overview of our training for today.
Hey, Warda. I think something's wrong with your audio and we haven't been able to hear you.
How about now?
Perfect.
Okay. Should I start over, Sabrina?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for flagging that. Yeah, so as I mentioned, I'll briefly cover the introduction from section one of the guidance, and the trainer speaking after me will cover content from the remaining sections of the guidance document. And as Ashley mentioned, the 2014 guidance covered remedy selection for contaminated sediment sites in great detail. And the graphic shown here on the right outlines the general process to be followed when capping has been selected as part of your remedy. You will see this graphic throughout the training, as each trainer will use this graphic to identify where we are in the process and which sections of the guidance are related to a particular step in this process. So you may have noted that section four was missing from the previous slide. That's because this training is not specifically going to cover section four of the guidance. However, the data needs outlined in section four will be touched on throughout the training as they inform all aspects of our discussion. Section four mainly consists of this table snapshot shown here, table 4-1, which summarizes data needs to support chemical isolation layer design, modeling, construction, and monitoring. And you can access this table and look at more details for data needs in the guidance document online. So, sediment capping objectives include physical stabilization to provide physical isolation and prevent particulate contaminant transport, chemical isolation to contain or limit migration and release of dissolved contaminants from underlying sediments, and the protection of benthic communities by preventing direct contact with the underlying contaminated sediments. These objectives are the same as the capping objectives that were presented in the 2014 guidance. However, today's training and the accompanying 2023 guidance focuses on the chemical isolation function of caps specifically. And with that, I'll hand it over to Bhavna to go over the capping overview.
All right. Thanks, Verda. Can you all hear me okay?
Perfect.
Okay. All right. Capping overview. This is section two that provides details on the capping objectives and particularly the chemical isolation function of the cap. So capping is a process of placing one or more layers of clean materials or a combination of materials or amendments to meet the objectives that Verda just described. The three primary objectives: physical stabilization, chemical isolation, and protection of benthic community. These are generally interrelated and can be combined to achieve site-specific performance objectives. Now, if site conditions are conducive, then a single layer cap may serve multiple functions to achieve these objectives. But in some cases, a multi-layer cap system may be required. So in this slide, we have a multiple layer cap system, and I'll go through the function of each of these cap layers. I would like to mention here that although this guidance documents is focused on chemical isolation layer, but it is important for us to understand the entire cap configuration because these different cap layers, they do contribute to the design of this chemical isolation layer. And Deirdre, our next speaker, will go in detail in that section. So I'll start with the configuration of this multi-layer cap system. The first layer that we are showing right on top of the sediment where is the basically a base layer. It's also known as a leveling layer. This layer basically creates even or a stable base on which rest of the cap layers can be placed. It prevents mixing of chemical isolation layer from the contaminated sediments. It also provides geotechnical stability and improves cap constructability. Then chemical isolation layer, this is the layer which is a focus of this guidance document. This layer is designed to inhibit migration of contaminants from the underlying sediments that generally occur via advection, diffusion, dispersion, bioturbation, or even gas ablation. And design of this layer, that depends on the nature of contamination and site conditions, maybe hydrodynamic conditions. Then on top of it is a filter layer, which is intended to mitigate mixing of chemical isolation layer from the upper erosion protection layer. This layer is typically used when there is a difference in the grain size of these two layers. So it is typically constructed with a medium-sized grains or geosynthetic that serves as a transition layer. Then erosion protection layer, also known as armor layer. This layer is intended to protect the physical integrity of chemical isolation layer from any anticipated forces that can be caused by hydrodynamic conditions or navigational traffic. And this is typically constructed from a range of coarse grain material or some manufactured materials. This guidance does not cover the design of this layer, but we do provide some of the references that can be used. Then habitat restoration layer. This is the uppermost layer that accommodates the benthic community after recolonization. The design of this layer may require different stone size or particular grain size. It might be addition of some organic material or habitat or substrate to basically promote the habitat in this layer. If fines are used, we might need to consider like a thicker layer to account for any loss of sacrificial material. And at times it might be required depending on the site specific or project specific requirements that we might need to go back and replenish this layer. Then surface layer on top of this cap is biologically active zone, which is called BAZ and will be referred throughout this guidance document. Right, so a range of cap configurations. A range of cap configuration and materials can be used to accomplish performance objectives depending on the site conditions. This first column is basically the layers that we just showed on the previous slide. The second column represents a scenario where a base layer may not be required. For example, in case of dredge and cap, this layer may be required to stabilize any dredge residuals prior to capping. But in some cases, we may want to place some combination of amendments post-dredging to address the contamination, and a separate base layer may not be required. Then third column shows where a separate habitat restoration layer may not be required. This could be the case if the erosion protection layer material provides a suitable habitat for recolonization or situs depositional, so a distinct habitat layer may not be required. I would like to mention here that erosion protection is important for the sites where there is a potential for cap disturbance due to high hydrodynamic conditions or other erosional factors that can impact the physical integrity of the cap. For low energy environment, minimal protection or cover may be required. And in that case, this layer could be constructed with the same material as the habitat restoration layer. Then fourth column, in this case, a filter layer may not be required. That requirement can be evaluated based on the selection of material for chemical isolation and erosion protection layer. Then this last one, this configuration is showing a single layer cap system where a single layer may serve multiple functions and can achieve more than one objective. For sites with low potential for chemical migration, a layer of clean materials such as sand or gravel can be used to create a physical barrier, which basically prevent any direct contact of the potential receptors from the contaminated sediment. And in this case, then a multi-layer cap system may not be required. The general cap types, these are three most commonly cap types. That includes unamended granular cap, low permeability cap, and amended caps. And these are based on the type of material we use for the chemical isolation function of the cap. Unamended granular caps, they are typically constructed of inert materials such as sand, stone, or other natural materials. These caps are permeable in nature. They are generally intended to provide a physical separation and increase attenuation thickness. They basically isolate contaminants and prevent direct contact of benthic organisms with the contaminated sediment. Low permeability caps, they are typically constructed of clay-based materials or geosynthetic liners. These materials are designed to provide relatively impermeable or low permeability barrier that reduces the advective flux of contaminants. And these caps also provide physical separation. They also impede upward flow of pore water and migration of contaminants. Amended caps, these caps consist of a wide range of reactive amendments. These caps are typically permeable that allow upward flow of pore water and retard chemical migration. Selection of amendment depends on the site-specific conditions and contaminants. For organic contaminants, typically activated carbon and organophilic clay-based amendments are used. If NAPL is present on site, we might want to use organophilic clays to address any NAPL and activated carbon to address any dissolved phase contaminants. For sites with heavy metal, amendments such as apatite, zeolite, or siderite are typically used. There is a table in this section that summarizes these different amendments based on contaminants. And there are also different placement techniques. These amendments can be mixed with granular materials such as sand, or they can be applied in commercially available bulk formulations or mat-based form. And then there are some cap models that have capability to evaluate these different amendments and even commercially available formulations that will be covered later in the training as well. Cap design considerations. So this slide illustrates four critical design factors, and they'll be covered in detail as we make progress through this training, as Vardha mentioned. So I'll just give a brief overview here. Chemical design criteria. It is important for the evaluation of chemical isolation layer thickness and selection of amendments because that depends on the type of contamination, level of contamination, and hydrodynamic conditions. Physical design constraints, that's important for design and constructability of caps. We need to understand site settings, navigational requirements, any geotechnical concerns, presence of debris or structures, any habitat requirements. Then we need to have an understanding of hydrodynamic conditions, any erosion potential or slope stability. Then permitting. It's important to understand permitting requirements and errors in the initial planning phase, as there could be some requirements that may need to be considered during the design as well as at the time of cap construction. And lastly, constructability. It is important to understand the constructability requirements from the initial design phase and to understand how the cap will be constructed. So if we need to consider any constraints that can be implemented during the design phase so that cap can be constructed as designed and specified. And with that, I'll hand it over to Tietra.
Thanks, Bhavna. So as Bhavna just described, there are many different cap types and configurations. And with those, we have different amendments that may be needed to meet your site goals. So in focusing on the chemical isolation layer, and defining that cap configuration, we often turn to modeling. And Danny Reibel is going to talk about that in the next segment of this training. So before we turn to the modeling, we need to make some decisions. And that process typically starts with an understanding of your design criteria. That is, what are you designing your cap to protect? So in this segment of the training, I'll spend some time talking about the design criteria and other considerations. All right. So when we talk about performance targets, the goal, often referred to as the remedial action objective, is to reduce the risk to human health or ecological receptors. And as you can see in the slide here, these examples, the REOs are pretty broad in nature. For example, for human health, reduce risks to adults and children from incidental ingestion and dermal exposure or consuming contaminated fish and shellfish. But when we're designing a cap, we really need the criteria to be more specific, right? More quantitative. And that's where we're going to get into the design criteria. So the design criteria, those are the requirements that the cap must satisfy. And these components typically answer the questions what, where, and when. So in the examples that we're showing here on the slides, the what are the concentrations or the fluxes, the where, so that's the depths that the chemical isolation performance targets apply, and we call that the point of compliance. The where is also what spatial scale these apply. And so these could apply over an area-wide basis, so that would be like a SWAC over a specified area. Or sometimes we need to apply these targets on a point-by-point basis. And then we get to the when. Or sometimes we call that or how long, and that's the time frame that the chemical isolation performance targets apply, and that we call the design life. So here are three different examples that show this what, where, and when of the design criteria in practice. And so, for example, the pore water concentration of contaminant X shall not exceed 1 nanogram per liter at a depth of 10 centimeters from the surface of the cap over 100 years. So, right, we have the what, we have the contaminant concentration, we have a 1 nanogram per liter, we have the where, right, a depth of 10 centimeters, and then we have the how long, 100 years. And so the other two examples show the same thing. The second one is an example where we use a flux instead of a concentration. And then the third one, we're showing an example with a SWAC instead of a point-by-point basis. So at this time, I'd like you all to think about potential issues that you've encountered when establishing your remedial goals. And so I'm going to go into a few examples. One example that I can think of is the uncertainty when the design criteria are based on a solid phase concentration, or you might call it a sediment concentration, when we're talking about organic chemicals. And on the next slide, I'll show you an example of what I mean. So here we're talking about the what, right? There's those three questions, the what, the where, and the when. So this is the what. And as I mentioned, the what could be a specific concentration or a flux that needs to be met. So for a design criteria that's based on a concentration that must be met, we have two options. We can look at concentrations on a pore water basis or on a solid phase basis. And we find it's actually helpful to evaluate performance of a cap either during design or monitoring based on a pore water basis. And that's because the presence of organic carbon in the cap will influence the concentrations on that solid phase basis. On a pore water basis, it's actually easier to understand if the cap is performing as expected. So on the left, we're showing an example of a typical cap profile. We have the sediment with cap on top, we have the sand, and the BAZ or biologically active zone in the top 10 centimeters. And the different lines or the model predicted concentrations at different time frames, 0, 20, 40, 60, 80, and 100 years. And so this is a typical profile where the concentrations are the lowest near the surface, which is at the top of the cap of this cap profile. And they start to increase as we get closer to that source, which is the sediment. Now, the graph on the right is the same exact model simulation, but in this case, the one on the right is showing the solid phase concentrations. And as you can see with this little call out, the concentrations are increasing at a depth of 10 centimeters and then go down as you get closer to the surface. So the reason for that increase that you're seeing in the graph on the right and that you're not seeing in the graph on the left is that in this model simulation, it's assumed that the biologically active zone, which will start to equilibrate with the surrounding sediments, will have a higher TOC than the sand below it. And so once the chemicals start to migrate up into that zone and they start to absorb onto that organic carbon, those concentrations tend to increase, right? So depending on what you assume for your organic carbon concentration in that zone, you may see a higher concentration with a higher TOC, or you may get a lower concentration if you assume a lower TOC. And so basically what that's telling us is that the results here are going to be highly impacted by that assumption. And by setting the criteria to a pore water basis, we can avoid the effect of that. All right, another example of a complicating factor is defining the design criteria can be impacted by the background concentrations. In dynamic environments that we often see in, rivers or lakes, the background concentrations can affect the surface sediment, and therefore they also can affect the surface of our cap. So in this image, we're showing a cap on top of sediment, and there's no deposition, right? No deposition, or if there is deposition, the deposition is low concentrations, below the RGs. The pink line at the bottom, which you see in the sediment, represents a concentration in the pore water. And what you'll notice is this graph is actually overlaid by an X and Y axis. So as we move from left to right, we have increasing pore water concentrations, and then we have the depth from the surface along what we call like the y-axis. And so what happens over time is that our chemical concentration in the sediment is going to start to migrate up to the surface. Now, on the right, see, we now have an example that shows the impact from chemicals on depositing materials, right? So this is an example where we have deposition of more contaminated or more elevated concentrations. And here we're going to see, as I click through this, we're going to see the impact that those depositing particles will have on the concentrations. And you'll see that this pink line is starting to move up, but at the surface, right? So at the bottom, we're seeing the same profile in both cases. But when we have depositing particles, you can now see the impact that those depositing particles will have on the concentrations at the surface of our cap. And so understanding this and knowing what these concentrations are, those can help you define a more realistic design criteria. The other thing is that these graphs also highlight the difference between what we call cap effectiveness and remedy effectiveness. So in both cases, the caps are actually behaving similarly, right? The caps are both attenuating the concentrations as we move away from the sediments, right? We end up seeing decreasing concentrations as we move closer to the surface. The only difference is that the one on the right is being impacted by something else, right? Something that the cap can't control. And so what we're seeing is the cap here is performing the same, but maybe the remedy is not performing the same in both these situations. And so by understanding this, we can look later to understand whether our cap is performing by looking at these types of depth profiles. And when we talk about that remedy effectiveness, Tamara is going to get into this a little bit later in the presentation about how this might affect your long-term monitoring. So the next question we need to answer is the where, right? And this is the point of compliance, which is directly related to our remedial goals. So here again, we have a cap on top of underlying sediment. We have a chemical isolation layer. And in this case, on top of the chemical isolation layer, we have an erosion protection layer or a habitat layer. And within that layer is where we have our biologically active zone in the top portion of that. So when the remedial goals are established to be protective of benthic organisms, the point of compliance is within or at the bottom of that biologically active zone. And this is because that's the zone where the benthic organisms live and feed. When we have remedial goals established to be protective of ambient water quality or fish at higher trophic levels, we really look at the point of compliance near the surface of the cap where the chemicals will flux to the water column. Now, when we do that, though, there's something that we, related to this is what we call the design evaluation depth. And so even though we have a point of compliance, we might actually look at a depth different than that point of compliance for which to evaluate the cap effectiveness. And this example shows a cap designed, again, to be protective of benthic organisms. Therefore, the point of compliance is in the biologically active zone. But the design evaluation depth may be different than the point of compliance, and that might depend on your environment. There may be reasons to assess cap performance at depths other than your point of compliance. Some reasons may include presence of armor stone, or even the confounding effects from deposition. And so on the next slides, I'm going to go through some examples of that. All right, here's an example of a cap with large armor stone. And so what you can see here is a large armor stone. Between it is water. And so that armor stone is not likely to provide a lot of attenuation of your chemicals unless it starts filling in with more depositional material. So the design evaluation depth in this case may be below the armor stone. Now, continuing with that same example of a cap that's designed to be protective of that biologically active zone, once the cap is placed, the benthic organisms are going to reoccupy the top of the cap. So the biologically active zone is at the top of the cap. And so therefore, the point of compliance is in the biologically active zone. Now, the point of compliance, as we have deposition over time, so moving left to right on this graphic, we have increased deposition with time. What's going to happen is that that biologically active zone is going to move with that newly deposited material. So you're going to see that it always stays at the top of our cap or deposition. If the depositing material is clean, that can contribute to additional natural recovery and provide additional attenuation. And in this case, you may ch choose this as a design evaluation depth as well. However, you may choose a design evaluation depth that is deeper, avoiding the influence of the depositing material and assessing effectiveness of the CI layer alone to provide attenuation. So that's an example where you may look deeper into maybe the bottom portion of your habitat layer or your erosion protection layer above the chemical isolation layer. Now, this is a case where we have both large armor stone and deposition. And so what's happening here is that you have that depositing material kind of filling in those pore spaces. And so this example combines the two scenarios that we just spoke about. And with that infilling, it will behave a little bit more similarly to the deposition example on that last slide. And so you could have two points of compliance, either within the deposited material where the biologically active zone exists, or somewhere deeper to focus more on the chemical concentrations that are coming right out of that chemical isolation layer. All right, so lastly, we're going to talk about the design life, which answers the question when or for how long. And so the design life is the minimum period over which the cap is designed to meet the design criteria. And so caps are designed to provide long-term risk reduction. And so a typical design life that is widely accepted is 100 years. It could be shorter depending on other circumstances. And so this graph shows an example output from CAPSIM showing predicted concentrations at a depth of 5 centimeters from the surface of the cap for 100-year simulation. So in this example, the cap was designed to meet the criteria, which is shown as that pink line, for more than 100 years. And you'll see that the concentrations at 100 years, so at the end of this graph here, you'll see that they're still below the criteria, which means that the cap is actually expected to perform at a concentration less than the design criteria for even more than 100 years. But just because a cap is designed for 100 years, which is our design life, its performance life may be longer, especially when we include the conservatism that's built into a lot of the design process. And there are a number of factors that can affect that conservatism, and I'll discuss those on the next slide. So, a number of things that enter for the conservatism of our design is our design criteria, right? Often those are just, come from risk assessments. Often we build conservatism into those risk assessments in the modeling that's used to define our, cap thickness and amendment evaluation. The input parameters that are used in those models are often conservative, right? We usually end up with more conservative seepage rates, contaminant concentrations in the pore water and the sediment beneath the cap. Our partitioning characteristics, deposition rates. So those are all things that have the largest influence on our model results, and they tend to be where we add in more conservatism. When defining the material specifications, usually we talk about minimum thicknesses and minimum amendment doses to meet the criteria. So then during construction, the contractor will often place more than is needed, in order to meet those design specifications. And so those are all the places where we build conservatism along the way. All right, so now that we've talked about the design, the process of defining our criteria, we can get into some of the other factors that affect the design. So in this example here, we're going to ask the question, are there any constraints on the cap thickness? So examples of constraints include flood control or navigation requirements. And so I'm going to use an example here of the navigation requirements. So what we're seeing here is that, given our site, we might have a minimum water depth that's needed for navigation purposes. And so that leaves you with only a certain thickness for the cap. So we're going to zoom in on that area that's left for the cap. Right. And so now we have to start considering what other layers are needed and how much room is left for the chemical isolation layer. And so in the guidance document, we refer to this as the top-down approach. So we're going to start going through the layers. The first layer, we might need a base layer. Bhavna spoke about that earlier. To resist erosive forces, we may need an armor layer. And then, depending on the size of that armor layer, you may also need a filter layer. And so that leaves only so much space left for your chemical isolation layer. And if this is not enough space, like you can add an amendment To keep that layer thin, or you may need to dredge to make room for that cap. So, in speaking of the amendments that might be needed to keep that cap thin, we can, cap amendments are often required to meet the performance targets. And those amendments depend on the type of COCs. Bhavna talked about them a little bit in her segment. And in some cases, a combination of amendments may be needed. It depends on what your COCs are. These amendments can be added as discrete layers. They could be mixed with other cap materials, or they can also be directly added to the sediment, and that sometimes we call that direct amendment. We would suggest that data be collected to support modeling for cap design, so how sorptive is the amendment at your site? And then also we want to consider the benthic community impacts when we talk about what amendments are being placed. All right, so section 3.4 of the guidance document provides a comprehensive list of other considerations. Listed here are just a few of those, but I really encourage you to spend time reading that section of the document. But just to go through a few, you may be able to optimize cap design based on spatial differences. And so things that could change with space across your site are things like your chemical concentrations, also the distribution of the contaminants. So this includes the geochemistry, which could also be important for some chemicals, particularly metals. The presence of NAPL that could change across your site. Sometimes seepage rates change depending on how large your site is. And then also, is it a depositional area, erosional area? And so, based on those differences, you can maybe divide up your site and optimize different cap types based on that spatial distribution. We talked a little bit about that biologically active zone. And so, sometimes looking into the benthic community structure and bioturbation, bioturbation depths are often like, on the order of 10 centimeters. Could be larger depending on your site. More estuarine systems tend to have closer to maybe 15 centimeters. But site-specific data may be needed using benthic surveys to sort of inform what you use. And then based on that information and what we talked about earlier, that biologically active zone, that thickness, may inform your point of compliance. All right, so we talked about the design criteria in detail, right? We talked about the different components. We talked about the what, the where, and the how long. We also spoke about some of the complicating factors in cap design and how we might handle those. We spoke about the design constraints, and we gave an example of that top-down approach that was used for navigation scenario. And then finally, I gave some examples of some other site characteristics that can be considered for the chemical isolation layer design. And again, there is a lot of information in section 3 of the guidance document, and I encourage you to spend some time reading that. And with that, I will hand it off to Danny Reibel, who's going to talk about the chemical isolation layer modeling.
Thank you, Deirdre. So let me so chemical isolation layer modeling. I tried to turn on my video. I don't see myself yet, so I'm not sure that's working. But if not, we'll just continue on. So isolation layer modeling. Deirdre talked a lot about some of the key issues that you may want to optimize, the processes and the design aspect, so that you can, in fact, optimize your system. And that's what we're going to be talking about now with chemical isolation layer modeling. So do I have control? There we go. chemical isolation layer modeling. So this is the tool, or we're going to talk about the tools that we can use to design our cap and to optimize it. And I'm going to talk a bit about why we're doing modeling, why a specific cap model as opposed to a model of the surface or groundwater, what tools are available, the important parameters that Deirdre's already alluded to, and then a bit about sensitivity uncertainty. We'll say at the outset, from all the processes and aspects of a cap isolation layer, a chemical isolation layer, you're not going to have all the information that you'd like to have. The question is, which do you have enough to be able to design and optimize your system? So some of the things that we might use a model to do, we're going to be predicting the performance of the cap, evaluating different designs. How thick of a chemical isolation layer do we need? What is that composition? What about amendments? Do I need activated carbon? Do I need to worry about powdered carbon versus granular carbon? Can I use organophilic clay? How do we evaluate what that composition ought to be to meet our design goals? Things that we don't necessarily understand very well, or we don't have good data on, or as good as we'd like. Well, an obvious tool approach to using the model is to evaluate sensitivity to those parameters. A model is fantastic for doing exactly that. If we have a range of uncertainty around our groundwater upwelling, well, let's evaluate what it might be over that range and see what the impact on design might be. And then ultimately, once we've constructed this cap, then a model provides us a tool to compare future data, monitoring data. We come back at a 5-year review. Is it behaving as we expected it, or are there processes that are causing contaminants to migrate more rapidly through the cap than we had planned and understood? And perhaps we need to update the model to deal with that. So why specifically cap models? We're probably used to dealing with surface water quality models, but the way that they interact with sediments is usually quite simple. They may have several layers of sediment, but it's effectively a boundary condition, and they're not looking in detail at the processes that occur within the sediments. The same is true in groundwater models. Groundwater models are designed to do exactly that, describe groundwater processes. The interface at the sediment water interface is, in fact, just a boundary condition. And generally, the level of detail is not adequate for trying to address cap design in either of those. There are a variety of unique processes that occur in that upper meter of sediment, and we're only really interested typically in that maybe 10 centimeters, maybe a meter, but rarely anything that is deeper than that. So what is effectively a boundary condition for each of those other models is exactly where a cap model is designed to work. Let's look at some of those processes that are important and what we might want to use a model to evaluate. Certainly, the surface water model can tell us about the shear stresses that might be present at the surface. And we may need erosion protection. We may need to place cobble or rock at the surface. Well, the cap model can incorporate that and evaluate what the impact of that might be on processes like hyperreic exchange or contaminant migration. Certainly, in most situations, we're looking at a stable sediment environment that's not really subject to erosion. That we are trying to protect from erosion. And therefore, it's what's in the pore water, that is, what's in the interstitial water, as Deirdre's already talked about, that is causing the migration of contaminants. It is groundwater upwelling, it's diffusion in that pore water, it's sorption onto the sediment, sorption onto amendments. And then when we get close to the surface, we're having bioturbation occurring. We're having really over the whole layer, perhaps significant changes in redox from more oxic at the surface to more reduced below that could have an impact on the fate and migration of your contaminants. The near surface environment, it's also important relative to hyperic exchange, especially if we have a granular media, sand, or coarser material at the surface. We're going to get a fair amount of hyperic exchange that may impact what depth is actually serving as a chemical isolation layer. So these are the sort of things that a model can come and take into account. A couple of models that are available. Recovery is available from the Army Corps of Engineers, breaks the sediment up into a variety of layers that have different processes that are occurring within each of those layers, primarily dealing with groundwater movement and sorption and exchange between these various layers. We also have CAPSIM, which we have developed at Texas Tech, and it is widely used. It has a graphical user interface, which makes it a little bit easier for many people to employ it. And again, it breaks the sediment up into a variety of layers that include in the near surface, perhaps hyperic exchange, bioturbation has exchange across the sediment water interface, including perhaps erosion and deposition in that layer. We also have the groundwater upwelling and the modeling of transport in that groundwater, as well as both kinetics of sorption as well as assumptions of equilibrium. Quite often, most people would assume local equilibrium, like we often do in groundwater models. And generally, that works well. But if we're trying to answer the question of whether we need powdered carbon or granular carbon because we're worried about kinetics of highly hydrophobic compounds, sorption under granular carbon, we can assess that within CAPSIM. We can look directly at the biogeochemical reactions. The, well, where do we, could we simulate where sulfate reduction is going to occur and where methylation might occur? We can do that within CAPSIM, although I'd have to admit that in most cases, individuals aren't using it for that. We tend to make fairly simple assumptions about the sediment that they can support and the nature of the design, the nature of the chemical isolation layer. And so most people use it only a portion of CAPSIM's capabilities. One of those capabilities is including commercial materials with realistic values for the amount of activated carbon or the bulk density of these materials. Everything from some materials that are produced by SETCO to Husker, to AquaBlock, AquaGate. These are all materials, setemite. These are materials that you may not have much experience with, and CAPSIM has their capabilities and their characteristics within the system. It also has a variety of estimation tools built into it if you wanted to evaluate kinetics. Well, there are ways of estimating that. If you don't have certain parameter values, well, there are defaults that are usually reasonable that can be used in the absence of contrary information. All of that is built into CAPSIM, and CAPSIM is downloadable from our website. Let's talk about, regardless of which model you employ, where do you want to focus your attention? And again, Deirdre's already addressed this, as well as the previous speakers to some extent. But you'll see if you're employing these models that identify them, first of all, what contaminant are you going to actually simulate? What's the concentration of those contaminants? And in general, you may only have solid concentration, and you'll have to use the built-in partitioning tools to calculate what's in that mobile phase, which is the interstitial water. But identifying what contaminant has a big effect on what your design is going to be, and certainly the concentration of that contaminant. Protecting a benzene from moving into the overlying water is a lot different from protecting for highly hydrophobic organics like PCB 101. So understanding which contaminants really are going to control your design. And generally, there's a whole range of contaminants, and you most often will identify a subset of that that have a range of concentrations and properties so that you can identify which one actually controls our design at a particular site. Because it's so critical to have, especially if we put amendments, it's all about retarded transport through the cap layer. So understanding what those sorption coefficients are. If we only have solid concentrations of contaminants, understanding those sorption coefficients that define what moves into the water and will be migrating is extremely important. Now, there are tools built in to evaluate or estimate those using standard approaches. But if you have site-specific information on sorption coefficients or good predictions on what they would be in your amended layers, then you should incorporate them. But there are defaults built into CAPSIM, and we have a database of sorption coefficients that could be applied, for example, for activated carbon for many of these compounds. Groundwater seepage rates, the number one factor in controlling how fast contaminants move through the chemical isolation layer, given a contaminant and given sorption coefficients, is how fast is the groundwater moving. If I'm in a rapidly upwelling area, I'm going to have a much more stringent design than if I'm in an area that is subject to only minimal seepage. And when I say minimal, I'm looking at perhaps centimeter a month or less of an average upwelling rate. But when I'm in a centimeter a day, I know that that's going to have to be incorporated within the design. And if I am in a 10 centimeter a day, which tends to be faster than you normally see in most locations, but if I've got that sort of upwelling rate, it's going to have severe effects on the design as to how I can manage that chemical isolation layer and whether I can even employ capping as an appropriate containment tool. Sediment deposition rates are certainly very important. In general, we often or quite commonly, we for conservatism, we don't consider deposition. But keep in mind, what is deposition doing? It's basically natural capping. And as a result, if there is any significant deposition, it just makes the cap work that much better. When we think of enhanced natural recovery systems, they're really attempting to perhaps in 1 year, put the equivalent of multiple years of natural deposition on a system. So sediment deposition rates are important. Although, again, if we're being conservative, we might not consider or we might not be confident in what a future deposition rate might be. And then, as Deirdre's mentioned, this depth within the cap for evaluating the design, that is an important selection to make. Often in the near surface, there's a lot going on. There's bioturbation, there's the hyperreic exchange, there's exchange across the sediment water interface. Often, right at the surface, the conditions are not controlled by the chemical isolation layer as much as they're controlled by the overlying water. We probably don't want to evaluate a design there. You know, we want to evaluate a design point. We want a point of compliance, or we want a point where we're going to evaluate design where the design of the cap actually controls that, which often isn't immediately right at the surface water interface, the sediment water interface. So those are key model inputs. There are some other inputs that may be important. The intensity of sediment water exchange. Generally, it's not important because we want a point of compliance or a design evaluation point, which isn't right at the sediment water interface. But if we have good mixing at the sediment water interface, then we're going to end up with the actual surface, the interface itself, being controlled by the overlying water. So again, that it certainly influences that surface layer of sediment. But if our design point or our evaluation point is, let's say, at the top of the or the bottom of the bioturbation layer or the top of the chemical isolation layer below the sediment water interface, then it's not very important. Kinetics of sorption under strongly sorbing phases can be important, and especially in those very dynamic upwelling environments. Let's say a 10 centimeter per day sort of upwelling with a thin layer that contains very little activated carbon. Those are the conditions where granular versus powdered carbon can make a difference. We also might be looking long term at what happens to these contaminants. Do they react away over time? That may be important, or it may build confidence as to the long-term design. But again, for conservatism, we often neglect that, but it's something that you could certainly incorporate and certainly incorporate within CAPSIM to evaluate what it might look like, even these very slow processes that ultimately will render the contaminant inert. So interpreting model results, we're not going to talk about how you use the model in this session, but again, it's just these this kind of our key notions that we should have when we're bringing a model to bear. Some of the things that should be mentioned in this is that capping is an aerial remedy, so that we're looking at an area. Maybe we have multiple areas within a site that we're having different designs that we're addressing. But we're not looking at a point by point solution. That is, I often use the analogy or the metaphor perhaps of a capping is not a balloon. If we puncture a hole in it, for example, we're doing some monitoring and we put a core through it, it's not like all the contaminants leak out from a cap. If we're trying to protect for the 90th percentile concentration, and we're trying to protect the overall area for perhaps a 90th percentile criteria. Again, capping is ideal and it should be recognized as such. It's that we are best evaluating it from the point of view of an aerial remedy, not a point by point worst case. We shouldn't necessarily be designing the entire area for a specific worst case. If it's important, separate it out as a sub-design. I mentioned before, and it's been mentioned before, that be careful of interpreting concentrations right at the cap water interface, because that interface may be controlled by processes in the water, not those that are in the sediment, not in the chemical isolation layer that we're trying to design. One aside on that is that the flux at this sediment or the cap water interface at the sediment water interface is controlled by what's happening underneath. And so the flux isn't as sensitive to what's happening in the water column, but concentrations certainly are. Okay. Trying to move forward. There we go. All right. And then finally, relative to sensitivity and uncertainty, one of the best opportunities that a model provides is the evaluation of the effects of parameters that you don't know very well, that are uncertain. You can do a sensitivity analysis and evaluate how does that design that I'm trying to build, how does that respond to those parameter, that parameter uncertainty and those variation in parameter values. But it's just very important to recognize that we may have a lot of parameters that are uncertain, but as I tried to identify before, some of them don't really have an impact on your ultimate design. Some of them, like groundwater upwelling, do have an impact on design. And so, where should we spend our time and effort? We should spend our time and effort trying to evaluate those parameters and understand those parameters at a particular site that are not only uncertain, but actually impact our design. Those in the upper right-hand box, if you will. Turn to the next slide. This is just an example output, and Deirdre showed some before of for CAPSIM, just showing the sort of information you can have. And you can change the what it shows you. This is perhaps a default example of the blue line that's squared off is showing a contaminated layer, in this case 45 centimeters below the surface. And then as a result of the cap layer with the mixture there that I've called it is activated. Well, it actually has sediment and sand, perhaps, with a sand layer for erosion protection at the top, and then a biologically active zone of sand at the top. And it's just showing the concentration profile as a function of time as it moves into that cap material. So that's the sort of thing that you would have by default, but you could also plot flux. You could plot solid concentrations. CAPSIM has the capability of if I put setamite at the surface, it will has the potential to describe how that setamite mixes through bioturbation into the sediment. So material transport as well as contaminant transport. Could also be evaluating concentrations or fluxes at a particular time over time at a particular location, as opposed to a plot like this. So you have a variety of options that you can look at your results. All the results go into an Excel spreadsheet so that you can use those any way that you want to decide whether your design meets the criteria that you're trying to. Turn to the next slide, and we're going to open it up for some questions, a convenient time for that. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Danny. So now we are going to go to the Q&A. Just as a review, the chat is closed for any of the attendees, but the Q&A is open. So please submit questions at any time, and we will answer them now and later on at the end of the modules. All right, so I'm going to go over one of the questions that we had answered in text, but just to see if someone wants to elaborate a little bit more. Connor asked, can you go into more detail about the mixing consolidation layer? What material exactly is to be consolidated and mixed? Are materials added to the top sediment layer post-dredging if implemented? Would anyone like to elaborate on that?
I can perhaps elaborate from the point of view of the modeling. And the so that in general, when you're placing material, the cap material, the chemical isolation layer, erosion protection layer, whatever layers you have on top of very soft sediments, you're going to see consolidation. The key issue from the point of view of capping is that that consolidation is expressing pore water up through the cap. So it could be the equivalent of many years of groundwater migration potentially. And so, from the point of view of modeling, it's just evaluating how much consolidation you are going to get and in what sort of time frame. So, for example, at CAPSIM, you're asked to, if you are expecting consolidation, you would evaluate how much consolidation would I expect if I have this weight of a cap on top of my soft sediment, and what sort of time frame is it going to achieve 90% of that? And so that's what we would use in CAPSIM to evaluate how much pore water is expressed and the contaminant migration that would result from that. It tends to be fairly small compared to the volume of water because most chemical isolations layers have significant capacity for sorption. So you might have 6 inches of consolidation and the equivalent of 6 inches of pore water expressed out, but it may only proceed a millimeter or a centimeter or two into your cap. and compromise that. But that is something that is a consideration that's needed when you're placing these materials on top of a very soft sediment. We would expect some consolidation. We work hard during placement, as you'll hear about soon, of ensuring uniformity of placement so that we don't have point loading and that we get whatever consolidation we're going to see is relatively uniform over the area. Thank you.
Thank you for that answer, Danny. And we're going to grab one more question and then keep it moving. So someone asked, what about bodies of water that are spring-fed? Won't these springs transport contaminants through any isolation layer, or is the remediation not appropriate in that scenario?
So again, let me perhaps respond to that is that it is certainly something that is worth considering if you have either bedrock or spring-fed groundwater, groundwater movement through bedrock is going to be channeled into the gaps in the bedrock. So places that you can evaluate that, you can use that as a source of uncertainty in a model and evaluate that. Recognize, however, that oftentimes if we have a significant upwelling in a small area, this is not the area that's contaminated. The area that has been contaminated is the area where at least remaining to be contaminated is where that contamination is not so active, or where that upwelling is perhaps not so active. If I have a chimney, that's not where I'm going to find those contaminants. So again, it's something to evaluate, it's something to assess, but it's the model could be used to do that. But if we really have very small areas where the upwelling is channeled to, it's likely those are not the areas that are retaining significant contamination, unless, of course, the groundwater is contaminated. So just something to assess as part of the process to evaluate whether that poses a problem or not.
Awesome. Thank you again, Danny. So let's keep it moving. We're going to return to the Q&A at the end of the modules. So if you have any questions, please put them in the Q&A and we will answer them as we go, written, and talk about them later. All right. So now I'm going to move this on and pass the controls over to Mike Ellis.
Thank you. Hi, all. Mike Ellis. I'm a senior environmental engineer with Barr Engineering in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I'm going to talk about construction considerations for the chemical isolation layer, or Section 6 of the document. So we've talked a lot so far about design of the chemical isolation layer in the CAP. We wanted to get into constructability considerations, and these considerations apply both to implementation of the CAP, so during actual construction, but also during the design. It's important that the design incorporates quality assurance and quality control, or QAQC, measures that are implemented during the work to verify that the actual construction of the CAP meets the objectives of the design. So all of the assumptions in terms of thickness and amendment ratios that are incorporated into the modeling of the CAP and the design of the CAP are confirmed in the field during construction. So on this slide, we have a conceptual figure of layers of the CAP similar to what has been shown previously. These CAPs can be fairly complex in terms of having multiple layers in the chemical isolation layer, being just one of those. The layers that we're showing in this conceptual diagram may be made up of the same material or different materials depending on the utility of the material, and the objectives of the project. One of the main considerations, when evaluating CAP placement is actual placement of these materials. The spread of the materials can vary depending on the equipment that is used, and the type of material in the water body in which it's being applied. So the spread of material is important to acknowledge to prevent any clumping of material, make sure there's a level surface, and also for geotechnical considerations. There are potential that there's requirements for layers to be placed in lifts to make sure that they are geotechnically stable. Cabs should be built from the bottom up or riverward to shoreward, as shown on this slide. And that helps prevent creating mud waves that can occur when material is placed on remaining sediment. And it prevents those mud waves from recontaminating freshly placed cap materials. So building the cap up is an important consideration during construction. It's also important that the cap is constructed from upstream to downstream, and that's also to prevent recontamination. So any mud waves of impacted sediments created by material placement are migrating downstream rather than upstream into completed portions of the cap. Another important consideration during construction is mixing of cap materials with the underlying sediment. And as shown in this conceptual diagram, we have a mixing or consolidation layer. And that can be done to create a level surface for the chemical isolation layer. The mixing or consolidation layer may be a separate material, so kind of like a leveling layer, or you may just consider some sort of sacrificial thickness of the chemical isolation layer. And that's because it will mix with the underlying sediments, and you want to make sure that you have the correct functional thickness of the chemical isolation layer that lines up with the design requirements. Another important consideration during construction of the chemical isolation layer is how amendments get mixed into that material. So what's shown on this slide is a conceptual figure showing a sand cap amended with granular activated carbon particles that would be what would be considered well mixed with the sand particles. So during the design, design engineers will dictate a dose requirement for the amendment. And when incorporating that requirement into the project specifications, it's important to consider how that requirement will be verified in the field and making sure that actual dosage is in a manner that can be easily verified in the field, whether that's by weight or by volume or some other measure. The way that it's specified in the project documents is important to consider. Another important consideration is that the amendment is well mixed with the aggregate material that it's mixed with. And it's important that it is well distributed. So the assumptions we made in the chemical isolation layer modeling are correct or put forth in the actual as constructed cap. And then verifying the integrity of the amendment can be important. There are certain amendments that may lose their integrity when they are mixed with the aggregates. So if there is verification that's needed either prior to or after placement to confirm the integrity of the amendment, that's important to incorporate into the project specifications and to confirm in the field. And we want to make sure the amendment is intact, so it functions as designed. This slide showcases some of the conventional placement methods used for sediment cap materials, and I'll just step through each of those. First, we have on this slide is a concrete bucket. It's good to use for shoreline applications and you can have a fairly high production rate. However, it does require shoreline access by a crew, which is showcased in this photo. And there are some difficulties associated with lift control. Another option is placement of cap materials with an excavator. Some advantages here are that this equipment is commonly available and can be used both from shore or from a barge. This method also has some difficulties with lift control and fairly low production rates. A clamshell bucket is another option for placement of cap materials. This is commonly available marine equipment and can result in higher production rates because of the bucket volume. However, the disadvantages is that a lot of clearance is needed for a clamshell bucket operated from a crane, like what's shown in this photo. As you can imagine, that wouldn't function well if there's overhead bridges or utilities or anything like that. And another common delivery method is a conveyor, which is shown in the photo on the far right-hand side of this slide. This method can have a fairly high production rate. However, you do need to find a way to continuously deliver material to the actual conveyor to take advantage of those production rates, and that can be difficult along with delivery from the conveyor to the actual desired placement location. In addition to some of the typical placement methods, we also wanted to highlight a few proprietary methods. Several sediment remediation contractors have their own proprietary app placement equipment, and that can be really beneficial because it takes advantage of all of their years of experience in the field and knowing what works well and what doesn't work well. So we've included two examples of those proprietary systems on this slide. On the left is a spreader system with hydraulic delivery. So cap material is delivered hydraulically to the spreader barge. And then that material is spread in a moon pool configuration. That allows for a more even distribution of cap materials in a fairly big area relative to what you would get from like a clamshell bucket or an excavator bucket. So the advantage of a system like this is that it has a high production rate and fairly even distribution of cap materials. However, it's hard to implement in tight spaces. As you can imagine, the moon pool configuration can prevent it from getting into corners or where there's ridge abutments or things like that. On the right is another proprietary system from a different contractor. It's pretty similar. However, it doesn't have a trying step, which the one on the left does. So the system on the right has hydraulic delivery of the cap materials and then placement in a moon pool configuration. So pretty similar advantages and disadvantages to this system. Both of these systems we'll need to consider qualities of the water body, things like any currents, things like that, that could result in high turbidity from material being spread out and placed in thin lifts. We want to highlight a few key issues related to placement and material loss as well. So for material placement and accuracy, it's really key to consider operator experience. Their experience can have a major factor in the quality of the placement and the accuracy of the material placement. And as I mentioned in the previous slides, the type of equipment used for placement has a significant impact on the accuracy. So verifying or evaluating contractors' proposed placement method is an important step when bidding out a project. It's also important to have substantial quality control measures incorporated into the project specifications that allow for accurate tracking of material placement during construction. I want to know things like where lifts are placed, the quantity that's placed, and the uniformity of the placement. In the next slide, I'll talk through some potential methods for verifying placement of CAP materials. But kind of standard practice includes use of RTK GPS-enabled equipment and routine bathymetric surveying, as well as some other direct measurements. Another important consideration during construction is material loss. Implementing contractors will need to consider material loss when evaluating the quantity of material needed for the project, so that'll impact their cost as well. Some things to consider when evaluating how significant an impact material loss will be on a project is material properties, so that's properties of the cap material, equipment accuracy, and placement conditions. And when executing a project, you want to be realistic about material loss. It's something that is going to happen. We'll need to find ways to control it with water quality controls, in a way to verify that actual placement meets the project requirements for thickness of each layer of the sediment cap. Another consideration is that different materials in the cap may have different tendencies for being lost during placement. So, materials with a lower bulk density have a tendency to drift during cap placement, whereas materials with a higher bulk density tend to, fall out of the water column quicker and less tendency for being lost. So, in scenarios where cap has an amendment, it's really important to consider how that amendment is placed. Things like activated carbon can have a fairly low density and have a tendency to separate out during placement. So this slide highlights a few standard placement quality assurance methods, and I'll step through each of those. But before doing that, just wanted to note that there's no one right answer for what makes up a good QA/QC program for implementing a sediment cap. It's very dependent on site conditions, the cap design objectives, and objectives of the project. So these can all be considered various tools in the toolbox and selected, as needed based on site-specific or project-specific requirements. So bathymetric survey is a tool that is commonly used to verify placement of cap materials. The advantage here is that it gives you an area-wide evaluation of placement, and it's commonly available. But some disadvantages are that it's not going to evaluate any mixing of cap with the underlying sediments or amendment additions. Slip-bottom profile is another method that's fairly commonly used. What it does is image the sediment so you can detect different layers of a sediment cap, which is important when evaluating thickness. However, it does not provide any information on the amendment addition, and it is very location specific, so you're not getting that area-wide assessment. Sediment profile imaging is another tool that's commonly used. This provides a view of the in-place material, so you can confirm mixing thickness as well as distribution of any amendments that are used in that layer of the cap. However, the disadvantage is that it is location specific, so you're only getting information at one specific point, and that might vary significantly throughout the project area. And there's a limited thickness that you can conduct those subsurface images below the top of sediment. Settling pans are a common and pretty simple way to evaluate cap placement. So these can be buckets or pans that are placed prior to placement of any cap materials, and then following placement of the cap layer, the pans are removed from the water column. And material that's collected in the pan can be evaluated for thickness or amendment addition. Some disadvantages of this method is that it is location specific, and it's not able to evaluate any settling or mixing. Collection of cores following placement of cap materials is another commonly used method. This does give you information on the thickness, amendment addition rates, as well as mixing with underlying sediments. And again, the disadvantage for this method is that it is location specific, and there's potential that the cap materials are going to consolidate or get compressed in the core, which will affect the evaluation of their thickness. So to wrap up the construction consideration section, I wanted to highlight a few key takeaways. The first is that evaluation of proposed equipment and contractors prior to starting the work is an important step. As I mentioned, operator experience and the method used for placement of cap materials can have a significant impact on the quality of the construction. Another key takeaway is that controlled placement of sediment cap layers is important to mitigate potential recontamination of cap materials. So following those steps of riverward to shoreward and upstream to downstream is important to prevent recontamination of materials. Also, amendment delivery is important consideration in sediment projects where there is an amended cap. Making sure the amendment is well mixed and both prior to and following placement of the material is important to make sure the cap is going to function as designed. And then finally, development of a robust quality assurance program is important. This needs to be site specific and needs to meet goals of the project and tailored to the sediment cap design. So vetting of the quality assurance program with contractors prior to construction is important to make sure it's implementable, and also that it will result in data that's needed to confirm construction of the sediment gap. And with that, I'll pass it on.
Hi, can everyone hear me? Okay,
Clear.
good. I'm having a lot of problems with Teams today. So this here, we are back at our, kind of general outline of this guidance document. And the last session, which I'm going to cover, is once all of this work has been done and you have your cap and it's in place, what you need to do in order to make sure that your cap remains effective and is working the way intended. Next slide. So, there are a variety of ways that you can use monitoring to determine cap performance. One of them, obviously, is to make sure that the installed cap conforms with the performance design. The other is to look at the chemical migration to determine whether the cap is performing its chemical isolation features. And then you do want to look at natural recovery, which is resedimentation, repopulation by your naturally occurring benthos. And then do you need to maintain or repair your cap over its lifetime? And what is that lifetime? bearing in mind that a cap, like any other built infrastructure, is an engineered product and that it needs some attention over time and may need some repair or refurbishment to make sure that it is in place and continuing to perform as designed. Next slide. So there are a bunch of different ways that we can look at the chemical isolation feature of the cap. You have these different layers that we've gone over this earlier in this course. And you can, first of all, see whether, in fact, you have these layers in place. And then looking at your chemical isolation layer, that is sort of your canary in the coal mine, because that is really where your functionality for chemical isolation should be occurring. So that is definitely a place to monitor. And then the question becomes, well, what is a good way to do so? Next slide. So you may have seen this earlier, and what we're looking at here is if you did something like pore water monitoring and you're looking at your chemical of concern concentrations, and when we say cap thickness here, we're really looking at the depth of the cap. So the first one shows what you would expect if everything is performing optimally. As you get shallower, you have less and less of your observed contaminant, which shows that your isolation function is working. The middle one shows that you do have declining concentrations, but they're certainly not going to zero, which means that some aspect of the chemical isolation feature is not performing optimally. Then you look at the last one, and that's kind of tricky, and you see that at the bottom and the deeper layer, it looks identical to the optimally performing cap, but then all of a sudden you have increasing levels of your contaminant, and that is typically not an indication that your chemical isolation is not working, but rather that you have recontamination, and then that goes to the whole issue of background, and that would be something where, you know, you may not be achieving your remedy, but it's not a problem with your cap. So hopefully you don't see that, and that your investigation prior to implementing the cap have ruled out the recontamination concern that you may get. But a lot of the things that we design chemical isolation for are very common in the environment, so you can often expect some level of recontamination. Next slide. So what exactly do we want to measure? So the previous slide looked at pore water being, of course, your dissolved phase. That is where you expect your soluble migration to occur. And that's kind of the gold standard for what you would look for. Can you actually measure the solid phase, your bulk sediment? You can. But then if you have a situation like the third issue where you have background recontamination, it's not really going to measure the performance of your chemical isolation function. It's just going to tell you what your contamination is. And you know, if you have a very unusual contaminant or something that you have already confirmed is not likely to be in background, it can be a much easier and less expensive thing to look for. But, you know, if we're talking about common metals, PCBs, pesticides, things we see all the time, you do want to be careful. And then surface water, I have seen a lot of projects where we do measure surface water. I'm not crazy about it because surface water, obviously, especially in a larger system, tends to move so much, and there's so much dilution that it's really unlikely that anything you measure is going to reflect your chemical isolation function of your cap. It might be an exception if you have something like a wetland where, you know, you don't have a huge amount of water and you have a very low energy system where your breakthrough might be mixing with surface water and could become detectable, but in general, not a great tool. And then we have biota. And as an aside, when this team first met several years ago, and we started talking about fish, it became very heated. And at one point, somebody even said, you know, next person who says fish is banished, you know, doesn't get lunch. So, you know, a lot of agencies really do want to see fish because sediment remedies, often fish, whether it's for wildlife food chain or for human health consumption, fish are a very important endpoint. And fish contamination is something that we're really trying to clean up for. That said, fish, of course, do also move around a lot in larger systems. You have fish that spend only a tiny fraction of their lifespan in what may be your site area. Some of the larger fish that humans eat may be anadromous. They're going out to the ocean and back upstream. So it's really hard to know whether what you're seeing in fish is in fact reflective of what is going on in your remedial area. The other issue is that, unfortunately, bioaccumulation of some contaminants, you know, like PCBs, dioxins, and more recently PFAS are a major issue. They bioaccumulate and those magnification factors are so high that just because of the way the food chain is and because of the age of the fish or a variety of other physical chemical processes, it takes a really long time for the fish to reflect an improvement in the sediment quality. So if you're in a site where, you know, there is a desire to monitor fish, I would just say that it's best to hold off if you can. Measure fish at 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, see if things are getting better, and they will, but it's certainly not straightforward. And, you know, if you're being asked to measure fish a few months after your cap is in place, guaranteed you're not going to see anything that reflects how well your cap is performing. Next slide. Moving on to maintenance. Again, your cap may be great, may be there till the end of time, or with you know, increasing concerns with more storm activity, sea level rise, and then you have man-made influences like boats, prop wash, you know, things that wrecks at the bottom, you never know what could be down there. And all of that could impact the integrity of your cap. Certainly, if you start to see migration of your chemicals, you're measuring pore water, for example, that could be a clue that you need to go out and take a look and see. Also, what is the elevation, your bathymetry of the cap? Do you see a lot of consolidation or settling that, you know, some subsidence could suggest that, you know, the cap integrity is failing? And of course, anything on a slope could show degradation. It is, however, worth pointing out that, you know, a small area of the cap that looks like it's, you know, collapsing or, you know, that it's disintegrating in some way, it doesn't necessarily mean that your cap has failed. These are area-wide remedies, and your overall cap performance may be fine, even if you have a little degradation around the edges or in certain locations. So it's not like, you know, it has to be pristine. It's a judgment call. Is it still working? Is it still in the place where it was constructed? Those are the things you're looking for. But your monitoring plan should include some kind of trigger or criterion for when you might want to go out and do maintenance. So, like anything else, it's good to have something there, a benchmark that you can rely on so that you know whether or not you really need to go out and do some kind of repair. Next slide. So overall, you think of your CAP the way you would a treatment plant or, any kind of built asset. It is an engineered product. So, keep an eye on it. Develop criteria. Think about things that are fairly easy to measure and monitor. And think about how often you're going to take those measurements. And then think about what your responses are going to be. Are you going to monitor more frequently? Are you going to evaluate whether it's really a problem, or do you need to go out and make some kind of physical repair? And finally, as I noted, you do want to make sure that you're not overreacting and local deviations are really not necessarily a problem for your overall CAP performance. Next slide. So with this, I'm going to turn it back over to Ashley to conclude this training.
Thank you, Tamara, and my fellow team members who have presented today. Our goal for this sediment capping guidance was to expand on the 2014 sediment remediation guidance by developing a comprehensive understanding of the design, construction, and long-term monitoring and maintenance of caps, with a focus on the chemical isolation function. So, to recap, designing the chemical isolation function is an iterative process that begins with understanding remedial goals and objectives. We use those objectives to develop a chemical design criteria specific to the contaminant fate and transport pathways within the cap. Chemical design criteria are the what, the where, and the when, or for how long, that serve as the conditions that the design needs to meet to satisfy the remedial objectives. Once these design criteria are developed, cap design involves selecting appropriate capping materials and thicknesses to achieve those design criteria. In addition to the chemical design criteria, it is important that the cap also satisfy other design factors, such as physical constraints, permitting and other regulatory requirements, and it must remain constructible. There are two available monitoring tools that have been developed specifically to support capping design, and these modeling tools can be used to estimate how well various cap configurations and materials can achieve the design criteria. Once a design is completed, it is important to convey cap construction requirements clearly to contractors and to employ construction quality assurance measures to verify that the built cap is consistent with the design. Finally, after construction, it's important to factor in how cap performance will be monitored, potentially in addition to other effectiveness monitoring approaches for the remedy. We recommend that cap performance data be compared with predetermined maintenance triggers so that it's clear upfront when cap maintenance should be considered in order to ensure that it will continue to meet its design objectives into the future. I believe our next step is taking questions. Am I correct?
Yes, thank you so much for wrapping that up, Ashley. So now we're going to go over into the Q&A. If you have any questions, please post them in the Q&A, and we will try to get through as many as possible before we finally wrap this up. So I'm going to go over one of the questions that has been answered just to see if one of our trainers would like to expand upon the answer. There's a question from Brad that says, can Sorry, wrong question there. Sorry, there's an anonymous question that says, what did you mean by water column effects under placement disadvantages? And Mike, I believe you gave an answer to this, but I was just wondering if you'd like to expand upon it a little bit more.
Yeah, can expand on that. Really, what's meant by that is that the spreader systems that were shown as the two proprietary placement methods have a thin lift of material, so it's materials spread out instead of a big bulk placement like you would get out of a clamshell bucket or excavator. So that can be subject to additional effects from water column. So if you're in a moving water environment, it may result in more drift of material, more material loss, or turbidity. Those effects can be controlled by curtains or things like a moon pool. However, it's just an important consideration to keep in mind.
Thank you so much, Mike. Did anyone else want to expand upon that? I have another question that is open right now, and it is for caps subject to tidal influence. How can we ensure best results interpretation? So this is referring to slide 45 in the first box. It says, be careful of interpreting concentrations at cap water interface. Would anyone like to answer that?
I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but I think it may be related to, what I said about, that your surface water is not necessarily representative of the dissolved phase material moving through your cap because there's so much flushing.
Hi, this is Deirdre. I can also add to that. So I think when we talk about tidal influence, sometimes what that means is that you'll have surface water moving down into your cap and into the sediments, and you also have groundwater moving up from the sediments and out into the surface water. And depending on what stage of the tide you're in, you can have this like back and forth movement. And that's in the modeling, at least, that's handled two like one of two ways. One is you can explicitly simulate the change in groundwater seepage rate or the direction of the flow with tidal oscillations or a variable groundwater flow. You can also keep the groundwater flow constant and assess the influence of tidal oscillations through an increased dispersion term. So, and then what the dispersion term does is it not only increases the transport of the chemicals up through the cap, but it also dilutes them. So there's this sort of balancing act, right, between the faster transport, but then also the dilution. And, you have to really test it out to see which one kind of drives that. And then as far as the compliance goes, be careful of interpreting concentrations at the cap water interface. So that's right at the surface. And that surface concentration that's predicted by the model will be very highly dependent on what your boundary condition is. So you'd want to be like further into the cap, in the bioturbation zone, at the bottom of the bioturbation zone. And I think by, staying away from that top grid cell that's right at the interface, you can sort of avoid that process that's right at the interface. But as far as the tidal influence goes, again, there's sort of this play between increased transport and then dispersion that will control. So as long as you're not right at that interface, I think you should be okay.
Thank you, Tamara and Deirdre. All right, moving on. It looks like we have a couple of new questions posted in the Q&A. One of the questions that someone asked is the purpose of sediment cap to prevent contaminants in the sediment layer from entering the surface water?
Yes, that could be you want to limit the amount of flux to your water column. Sometimes, depending on your criteria, it's also to reduce the concentrations at the surface of your cap, which is where the benthic organisms are going to live and feed. And so you want to limit exposure to those organisms from the chemicals that are coming from the sediments below. And that also then impacts, right, the food chain, right? So what are other organisms feeding on and, getting into the fish? But certainly reducing the flux to the surface water column is one of those goals.
Thank you so much again, Deirdre. All right, I just want to check to see if anyone is able to answer this. I'm just going to take this one last question. Can I apply sediment cap chemical isolation to our river polluted with acid mine drainage? Is anyone able to answer that? If not, we can move on. All right, I'm not seeing anyone coming off mute, so we are going to move on. I'll go over one more question that is answered just to see if we are able to expand upon it. Someone asked, what has been shown to effectively supplement the missing settling and mixing data for bathymetric surveys conducted in tidal areas? And this refers to slide 56.
Yeah, I can follow up with more information on that one. Most of the other tools included in that slide could be used to supplement the bathymetric data and evaluate mixing or settling the sediment cap layers. So things like the sub-bottom profile sediment imaging along with sediment cores, they could all work to supplement that bathymetric data. The tool that's best fit is just going to be based on the project objectives. So you need to consider it on a case-by-case basis, but there's several tools that could help supplement.
Thank you so much, Mike, for answering that. And at this time, we are going to wrap it up. So I just want to say thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRZ document. Please give them a round of applause to yourself since we can't hear you. And we would like to hear back from you today. So please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. When you fill out the feedback form and certify that you participated, you will receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need any further clarification on answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thank you again.